Hi, welcome to the Learning Blog with Alex Ragone. On Friday, February 17th, 2006, I had a conversation with Jeff Mao, Coordinator for Educational Technology for the Maine Learning Technology Initiatives, about 1-in-1, the stories of the Maine Laptop Program, and what schools who are thinking about 1-in-1 should be doing to prepare. I've known Jeff for about 6 years now through listservs and the New York State Association for Independent Schools Conference for Information Technology Managers, where Jeff and I have had many interesting conversations about friends, family, and technology. Jeff has always impressed me with his clear thinking and amazing communication skills. The guys on more listservs and manages more email than anyone I know. Jeff balances family and work and loves Maine, as you will hear. He's an amazing leader for the Maine Learning Technology Initiative, and I'm honored that my first podcast is this conversation with Jeff. How are things going?
Going well. We are in the thick of getting our RFP and all that stuff. So the RFP has been out since January. The due date is next Wednesday. So come next Wednesday, we're hoping to see at least two or three, four bids for the project, and then we can start reading them and go from there.
I've seen the plan, but I haven't actually read the whole thing. So where are you guys going?
The RFP in general, it's pretty much focused in the same way that it was last time, and it very much reflects what we've continued to do on the project, which is very educationally focused. As far as kind of the numbers and specs, it's still looking to provide one-to-one devices for every 7th and 8th grade student, every 7th and 8th grade teacher, including librarians, principals, tech leaders, those folks in the schools. Wireless networks. We've asked the bidders to either, provide us with solutions for either upgrading or completely replacing the wireless networks. Communication and email systems for those users. And then, if you read through it, what you'll find is that it's very specific. It does not address things like there's no megahertz and gigahertz and anything like that in the requirements. It's mostly written like it'll simply say, we're looking for tools to facilitate the writing process. We're looking for tools for data analysis, tools that will help with multimedia creation and viewing. Rather than being very specific, we've seen some large districts and even, like Henrico and those folks, they'll put something out that literally says, we want Office. And on one hand, I think a lot of people like to have Office. But in general, it kind of goes in opposite our goals, which are really to focus on the education and not on the applications. And then in general, if we're going to do an RFP, which is to look, in a public bidding arena and say, try and solve this problem in the best way that you can, if we specify Office, then we've kind of violated this whole concept of a public open bid, because now we just handed business to Microsoft.
Right.
And it's supposed to be an open bid process where anyone who has a product that meets the requirements has an equal shot at winning. So, we tried to stay clear of that kind of language in the RFP.
So who are you expecting to respond?
We're hoping to see response from the major hardware, even though, it's not a hardware thing, but we're expecting that the hardware vendors tend to be the lead companies. So the companies themselves, or the bids themselves, typically, just as our current contract, it is with Apple, but behind that are a number of other subcontractors that Apple works with, both in the installation of the networks, in providing some of the software. Our communication system is running first class, so they've got a number of subcontractors they work with. So we're anticipating that the same types of consortiums will be put together, but we asked the bidders to present themselves as a single entity, so that when we have all of the project management business dealings, we simply have one person to approach. So I don't have to call one company and say, hey, a network is down at such and such a school, and have them say, well, are you sure it's our network and not the computer? In this fashion, it's literally we have a vendor who provides a total solution, and we can say the solution is not working and it appears to be the network, And they'll say, okay, well, we'll go check it out, you know, and if it turns out to be the network, they'll fix it. If it turns out to be the hardware on the computers, they'll fix that, you know. But it's that way we don't have to have people pointing fingers at each other. I mean, I've heard of these, you know, those the horror stories of just the individual user calls Microsoft who says it's not our software, it's the hardware. You call Dell, you talk to someone in India, you can't understand them. They tell you it's Microsoft's product, you know, I mean, you just go in circles.
Yeah, so, it's like calling Verizon.
Right. I've tried to do that recently, in fact. I've got DSL at my house, which I think I mentioned to you in the email, is not quite so good. And it's through a local main ISP, but I know that Verizon actually owns the line because, you know, the local ISP doesn't have it. So it's really a Verizon line, but I'm paying this other company. But the company only provides 3 megabit service and up, and they charge me for that, but I only get 768 because I'm so far away from the center. So Verizon now advertises, well, 768 DSL, it's only $15. I thought, oh, well, I'll get that. So I call them up, and they say, well, I'm sorry, sir, we don't service your area. But I'm getting DSL from you now. No, you're not.
Right.
No, yes, I am. So, yeah, so we're hoping, you know, we really don't know, but we're hoping to see responses from all of the major bidders or the major vendors, you know, and so that we have something to compare.
Right.
I'm fully anticipating we'll see a bid from Apple because they are the current bidder, and I think they've been pretty happy with being our provider. So I would expect them to continue to try and stay in the game. But I think since we started this, you know, 4 years ago, I think a lot of the vendors looked at this kind of idea and thought, "Ooh, I'm not sure I want to get into that."
Right.
Today, if you look at the landscape, you know, like the announcement just came out the other day, Henrico's Middle School in Virginia chose Apple again, and that was like 16,000 devices. High school this fall chose Dell, and that was, you know, like 30-some thousand devices. So even within that one very large district, they've got both. You know, so
Dell right.
was in the game. Apple was in the game.
Yeah.
We've got folks that we've worked with from New Brunswick, Canada, who are using HP. You know, so they're in the one-to-one space. So we know that these vendors are in the space. It's just a matter of whether or not they want to be in our space.
In the main space.
Right, main space. And I know we know that, you know, we still like to think of ourselves as the biggest and the, you know, the most major project. And so we're hoping that's of enough interest to the bidders that they want to get in the game.
Yeah, we've been actually testing some of these IBM X41s,
mm-hmm.
the tablets.
Yep.
And that's created a conversation at Collegiate that couldn't have happened before.
So people starting to talk about what they can do rather than how do I use Word?
Yeah, big time.
That's good.
So I think, like, I'm hoping that having conversations with guys like you and Fred Bartels and Bill Knauer at Packer is going to help give me some evidence.
Right. Yeah. We are near but not quite done yet with some reports. I think we've got a report that hopefully will come out within the next month. We had preliminary data that we presented to the Education Committee in the legislature the other day, and I guess technically since they saw it, it makes it public data, but the researchers don't want to really push it out there yet. But we've got some pretty good compelling data around kind of survey work. You know, I think the difficulty, and I find this all the time because working at the state level, one of the other things I do besides MLTI is I help manage federal Title II D grants, which in the private sector you never see, but those are dollars that the federal government sends out to states to distribute to schools to help support technology under the NCLB Act. The feds are looking to try and cut it, but nonetheless, we do have dollars now that, you know, we're looking at, and for the last couple of years, you know, the pressure has been on to try and prove that these dollars have been effective. And so, of course, the struggle we've all had at the state and school levels is how do you try and prove that technology in and of itself impacted student achievement positively? Because we
right.
know that alone, you know, you can't just drop a computer in a room and things happen and all of a sudden scores go up. That's just not the way it works. You know, we know that technology is a tool, just like a textbook or a whiteboard or a chalkboard or whatever, and used appropriately with the right professional development, you know, and that whole game, that student achievement will get better and that kind of thing. So it's been tough to do that kind of direct correlation thing. And of course, that's what the legislature is pushing away at, you know, show me the proof, show me the proof.
Right.
The kind of proof that we have are more things like, you know, when surveying teachers, you know, what are their feelings around, you know, do they feel like they are better prepared Do they feel like they can produce better content materials for their students in order to have them meet the main standards? Do they feel students are better engaged? You know, those kinds of things. And then we ask the students the same kinds of questions. Do you feel more organized? Or, you know, to what degree does the laptop help you do this, that, the other thing? You know, are you more likely to edit your work, you know, your writing, if you use a laptop versus not? And, you know, and those kinds of questions. And overwhelmingly, the responses we get are in the positive. You know, that point us in the direction that we want to see, which is, you know, students do feel like if they're using a computer, they're more likely to edit their work, which drives us toward things like, you know, we're not looking at a computer as a finishing product, you know, create a finished product, but at the writing process. And we know part of the writing process is editing. You know, you've got to be able to write a draft, go back through it, edit it. And if using a computer makes a student more likely to do it, then that means to us that it's going to lead to better writing. You know, so the way the U.S. federal government now has started to kind of push away at it, they've kind of relaxed this notion that we need to try and prove that Title IID dollars have a direct correlation to student achievement. Instead, what they're now telling us is, you know, what we'd like you to do is, you know, worry about those things that you know where technology is helping impact positively those precursors, those things that you know lead to student achievement. So rather than having to say, you know, because we introduced a one-to-one laptop program, test scores went up, but we can say, well, through this program, we have been able to provide more professional development for teachers. You know, and here's our data on the effectiveness of that, you know, the user ratings, the survey work we've done with teachers around, you know, what were their feelings about having done this professional development, and do they feel better prepared, and these kinds of things. And in some instances, we even have a math program we're working on that shows that, you know, teachers are actually increasing their content knowledge around mathematics, you know, beyond their teaching styles and pedagogy, but their true just simple math content knowledge. We've given them those kinds of math tests, and those are on the rise, which we know will lead to better teaching, which then leads to student achievement. But, you know, so we've gotten away a little bit from that direct correlation thing because it's too difficult. There's too many variables. And as one of our legislators pointed out yesterday, who's very supportive of our project, she was saying that, you know, in medicine, it's not uncommon to find people who are willing to go into a drug study and take the risk that this drug they're taking is a placebo. But what parent is willing to send their student to a school under the conditions that the education they may be receiving is a placebo? You know, so we can't do very easily this kind of scientifically based research in education, because in order to do it, you have to have control groups, which means you necessarily deny a portion of the larger population the intervention.
Right.
So it means like, okay, so these kids over here, we'll teach them how to read. These kids over here, we won't.
Yep.
Let's see
yep.
how it goes. You know, you can't do that. I mean, everyone has to learn. And so it's very difficult to do this kind of research in education. And then beyond that, the cost is exorbitant. So we are doing this, a scientifically based research project. We have a federal grant. They gave us a little over $3 million. And that $3 million is we're spending about $1 million a year to try and do this very focused study on the impact of the teaching of mathematics using technology. But, you know, local districts do not have that kind of money, and states don't have that kind of money to do studies as opposed to direct intervention. You know, if I had 300 spare dollars, people aren't going to say, oh, let's do a study. They're going to say, hey, buy me some computers, or buy me some professional development time, or raise my salary, or fix that roof. They're not going to say, hey, go write a white paper.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's really important work in this space.
Right, and that's why we've continued to push away at it. And one of the things that we were expressing to the legislators, you know, in talking to the Ed Committee and the Appropriations Committee about this, is that because of this project, what it has done is it has opened doors for us as a state and enabled us to apply for and receive grants that otherwise we would never get to do exactly these kinds of things. And we never would have got this federal grant if we didn't have MLTI.
Right,
right.
We just had a group down in the South Portland region get a major NSA grant to generate and produce virtual DNA labs that you can run over a computer, because obviously no school has the equipment to do DNA sequencing.
Right,
right.
Right, but they're going to try and produce electronic virtual versions of the equipment just so that kids can actually do that the same style of experimentation, exploration, without having to have a DNA sequencer.
That's amazing.
You know, that's
and to draw blood from things. You know, I mean, you're just not going to be able to do it. But we never would have got that grant without the project because, you know, they're able to put on to this, to the NSA, well, you know, what's our test bed? Well, our test bed is 38,000 kids in middle school who all have a laptop. You know, so we can easily get a cross section. We can have, you know, we have high poverty areas, we have wealthy areas, we have rural areas, we have urban areas, you know, we have the whole mix because we're an entire state. So it definitely opens doors that, you know, otherwise we wouldn't have opened to us.
That's pretty amazing. So it is amazing when you have 38,000 people that do this.
Right. And, you know, and the thing is, of course, we're the biggest right now. And, of course, our work has then inspired all kinds of other people, like the MIT Media Lab and some of our friends. We know that Florida just announced that they want to do something. Pennsylvania just announced a project. They want to go one-to-one and do a big project.
I heard somebody, the Illinois one, talk about Linux.
Well, they don't really know exactly what they're going to do. I know they've had conversations with Apple and with other vendors. They've literally been inviting vendors in to discuss the idea. Ultimately, just like us, they'll go to RFP.
Right.
But Illinois is looking at 169,000 students in grade 7.
Oh, my God.
You know, because, I mean, they got Chicago.
Right.
That's bigger than Maine anyway. Right there. you know, in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and other big cities, that place is huge, too. In Florida, you know, that's the mother load.
Right.
Right.
So, and then, and even any of those places are dwarfed when you think about the MIT project. We had the government of Brazil actually sent a task force to Maine to come study what we were doing and talk to us because they're one of the early countries that the MIT group has targeted for the one laptop per child program.
Right, right.
And Brazil will probably be one of the first countries to deploy over 1 million units.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that,
you know,
1 million units is just insane.
It's just
right.
insane.
And so that's, you know, that's going to necessarily change the world. And I think, you know, if you're looking for ammunition for your local schools, you know, one of the places to go is to simply show them, you know, you pull down, I don't know if you can save it because I think it's a real streaming movie of Negroponte at the World Summit
yep.
in Tunisia
yep.
talking about the project and this notion of transforming the developing nations, you know, and this concept that, for example, China, who wants in on the game, if China decides that they're going to, and I know they've discussed this, they want to take 3% of their population and make them engineers and scientists and make them high-end, kind of in the same way that India has really invested in education, and they want to do this through one-to-one. And if China's successful, and you can expect they will be because China has ultimate control, you
right.
know, they can go and pick a child out of the household, you know, it may not be the most humane thing in our view, but they can do it. If they're successful, 3 million people, that's like, I think the last time I did the math, it was something like 36 million people or something.
Oh my God.
So if it's 36 million engineers, what's that going to do to our economy? It's going to kill us.
The world is flat, right, Jeff?
If our country doesn't keep up,
yeah.
we're going to fall behind. And the complacency that we may have is going to kill us because we don't realize how quickly, you know, the world may be flat, but the MIT project will very quickly reverse everything.
Right.
Because all of a sudden, while the system is relatively flat, the access to the system still isn't totally there.
Right.
But this
right.
could change that. You know, all of a sudden, 1 million people in Brazil, 3 or 4 million in China, you know, everything will turn upside down. And I think everyone has always known that the world economy will shift to the Far East in the next 50 years.
Definitely.
Definitely.
Resources and the numbers of people and manufacturing and things. China's just going to try and jumpstart that. And if we don't hurry up and stay ahead, we're going to hurry up and fall behind.
What do you say? What do you think are the biggest skills that kids in Maine are getting that are really beneficial for this program, like 21st century learning skills? I've been kind of throwing that concept around in my head a lot lately.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that, you know, like we were discussing this yesterday in the Ed Committee, that, you know, because some people were asking, you know, why isn't the MEA, which is the Maine Educational Assessment, it's our statewide high-stakes test, you know, why isn't that a good measuring stick for this project? You know, if we look at scores on those tests, shouldn't we see changes in scores because of the program? You know, and what we've been saying is, no, we don't, because that test is a 20th century test. And we looked at sample questions, and you look at these questions, and most of them are recall questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the kinds of work that you would do kind of in that 20th century model or even 19th century model. Today's model is more, instead of just kind of asking, you know, a simple recall of, you know, how much or how many or when did this happen, it's, you know, using appropriate data analysis tools, you know, look at shifting populations in the state of Maine and, you know, discuss what the economic impact may be, or why is, you know, what are the economics that are driving the population shifts, or, you know, what, I mean, it's all kinds of open-ended inquiry-based questions that can be asked when one looks at, for example, the state of Maine, because we know, based on our just demographic figures, that we have a population that's shifting south and west, which, if, strangely enough, in Maine basically means they're moving toward the water and toward Boston.
Right.
Right.
And so, you know, why is that and what's happening? And, of course, you know, some of the simple answers are that the northern and eastern areas of Maine tended to be those areas which relied on natural resources for their economies, fishing, lobstering, paper products, you know, wood products. And today's world, it takes, I don't remember the exact specifics, but I know Angus King's good at throwing these things around. That's why he was a governor. You know, I think it was something like, you know, 50 years ago, the number of men it took to clear like an acre of land was something like 50 men, you know, if it came to, you know, logging. And today, one.
Yep.
Yep.
You know, so the reality is that that kind of natural resource-based economy is not sustainable for a large population anymore. And that's why things are shifting. And that was one of the reasons why he came up with this as an idea, as a project, because he recognized that, you know, we weren't going to change the natural resources issue. That was going to continue to be an issue. So what we had to do was to be ready for the new economy, to be ready for this idea that we would have people who could continue to live in Maine, as many people always want to. You know, they want to have this kind of quality of life here in Maine, and, you know, being away from big urban centers, and, you know, and having the four seasons, or five if you consider mud season a season. But to be ready for that global economy where, you know, you have those skills that simply allow you to function, because again, the world is flat, right? So you don't have to necessarily be somewhere if you're not stuck in a either manufacturing style position, which necessarily means you're near the factory, or a natural resource based economy, which means you're near that natural resource, whether it's the ocean or the woods. You know, but instead, the simplistic answer is, you know, oh, well, I could be a web designer and live anywhere.
Yep.
That's absolutely true. You know, the woman who works for me here, she's our project assistant. She does all our web design, and she's pretty good at it. And one of her little side jobs is her sister has this online store that sells like midwife and natural birthing products and you know, cloth diapers and, you know, that kind of more traditional style of child rearing stuff. And so she's been writing the website for this with the online store and doing all that kind of stuff. And so she's been working with the guy who wrote the database back end of it. The guy just offered her a job today, looking at her stuff, going, wow, this is great artwork. Do you want to be one of my designers? You know, I said, you can't leave us. I said, don't you dare go anywhere. And she goes, yeah, but, you know, he's down in New Hampshire. I said, so? And she's like, yeah, you're right. I don't need to be in New Hampshire. I mean, I just need to be at a computer. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, and Maine is a state also that's very fortunate. What we did years ago was they worked out a deal with, I think at the time it was 9X, to, but you know, it's now Verizon, to, we created the Maine School Library Network. So the Maine School and Library Network is the ISP for virtually every K-12 school and library in the state of Maine. And we have T1 lines running into every school building. And it's paid for through E-rate dollars and a local Maine-based E-rate tax. You know, everyone's phone bill has its little tax. The reason we were able to convince Verizon to work this out and convince the legislature to create this tax was, what it did was, every single community has a school, right? So now in every single community in the state of Maine, there's fiber, because they had to run the fiber to get the T-line to the school, which means that the entire state's infrastructure is ready and waiting for anyone who wants to add in a data center. You know, which is why unfortunately they've closed because MBNA is going through their corporate restructuring things. But MBNA immediately pounced on that. They had two or three huge call centers in Maine, one of them right in Camden, right on the coast, and offering some, you know, really high quality, high paying jobs. And, you know, some of the stuff is kind of what we would think of as more low end, but they are definitely higher paying for the less skilled workforce. But, you know, like, I think it was one of the cell phone providers, I forget which one, just opened up a new call center up in the middle of the state because there's fiber there and it was cheap.
Yep.
They could just, you know, build a building, stick a bunch of phones in it, but they've got high-capacity fiber. So the state has a lot of things that they've put together in very thoughtful ways for long-term thinking about trying to be ready for this new economy. The key now is that, and this was the bottom line figure that the king was aware of, the bottom line is you can have great infrastructure, you can have attractive tax laws, but if you don't have a workforce, you've got nothing.
People.
You got to have the people. Yep. And that's what he was really targeting, was this recognition that we've got to do something that isn't the same as everybody else. We have to leapfrog everyone. Because if we all do the same things, then Maine will continue to be 38th in the nation.
Right.
Right.
You know, but if we can leapfrog everybody, then we can start to make up the difference. Because we, you know, one of the struggles in Maine is that folks from down where you live are buying up chunks of Maine, salaries that no one up here has.
Yep.
I mean, I have friends who live on the, who have summer places in the coast that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars that I know that no one here in Maine could ever purchase.
Yep.
You know, and we don't want Maine to, you know, the Maine nickname is vacation land, but ultimately I think it's a love-hate relationship. You know?
Yeah.
People like the tourists, but they hate the tourists.
Right.
Right.
You know? So we can't rely on them, and we don't want the entire coastline to be owned by tourists or, you know, people from away, which is, I still fall into that category and will always fall into that category. But, you know, it's the same, I think it's the same fear we had in the 80s when people started to say that Hawaii was becoming Japan.
Yep.
Yep.
When Hawaii's waterfront was getting purchased by all these major Japanese businessmen and companies. You know, and Maine is going through that same kind of thing, but it's folks from Connecticut and New York.
Definitely. Hey, what are some of the really huge success stories that you can talking to the state senate or people around the country?
Well, I think some of the things that we look at, you know, on the small scale, there, you know, because one of the things about the Maine project and Maine in general is that Maine is a local control state, like many states, which means that from the State Department, we cannot mandate textbooks, we can't mandate practices, we can't mandate anything except simply, here are the state standards that we want you to live up to. How you get there is totally up to you, right? So the laptop project was kind of a unique thing in a sense that we universally as a state said, here's the resource. But then it was left to the district, okay, now you decide how you're going to use it.
Right.
You know, we've got the tool, which kind of leads back to that RFP, you know, that it was a tool that was very generic in its sense that we wanted to support all the various educational needs that we knew existed. It's up to the schools to decide how to do that. So, for example, one of the schools that is kind of down East Maine on Mount Desert Island, there's a research lab out there full of scientists. So they built a little website system on their school website that kids can, anytime they've got any kind of scientific-based question and they can't answer it, they can post it into this little website. It's essentially kind of like a blog. And it automatically emails all the scientists, and one of the scientists will answer.
That's so great.
And
that's so great.
Usually that day. You know, and so what it's done is it's tied all these kids into a resource that typically you wouldn't have. You know, and you could say that, well, anyone could have that in any school because you could just go down the hall and ask the question. But, you know, I think it's having the one-to-one access kind of helped jumpstart that.
Mm-hmm.
This note that, you know, well, any kid can ask at any time. At home, at school, whenever. So, you know, it's little things like that that we often point to. You know, we have a lot of projects where, you know, one of the things that is kind of built into the middle school curriculums and history is the sense of not just studying dates, but, you know, getting a deeper connection to both Maine history and world history and things. And so, you know, instead of having people just writing reports, now we've got multitudes of school projects where kids have gone out and either done things like we're doing, kind of audio interviews as well as video interviews and you know, collections of various kinds of media projects to help record the history of whether it's just simply their town or it's World War II veterans or whatever, you know, to keep that history alive and archived in a way that, you know, normally would have just been the written word. But now you can include, you know, the actual true story as told by the person who was at Pearl Harbor.
Multimedia.
And not the retelling of what he told me when I talked to him on the phone, you know, or even having, you know, a video conference with him or literally just taking the camera to his house.
Right.
And
right.
Filming it. And then, you know, the ancillary kind of connected things that kids get out of that is they also then learn a little bit about media production. which isn't a bad thing. You know, I mean, we don't want to focus on the technology per se, but you know, you do get kids who get into that kind of thing who you might normally not think of as hugely connected with school, you know, but they do like to tinker with these other things, you know, and we all have some of those kids who, you know, spend hours playing video games or other things, but, you know, trying to get them to do their English homework or something, yeah, it's hard. But now all of a sudden this kid gets to do video production while they're doing their homework.
Right.
Right.
All of a sudden they're engaged with their work, and even though they were thinking about the technology, along for the ride, they learned a whole lot about the other things, and you know, you do that enough, and a lot of those kids start to recognize, this isn't so bad. You know, this is not dry reading a textbook that, you know, when I look at the front page, the front inside cover, and there's that little box where you're supposed to write your name, and those things in those books and all those textbooks, and you can see that your big brother, who's 7 years ahead of you in school, had the same book,
yep,
and the teacher thought it was funny to give you the same book. And, of course, we realize as adults, oh, my God, we have the same book from 7 years ago?
Yep.
You know, and think about your science textbooks. Does your science textbook talk about the solar system and how many planets are in it? Because if it does, the book's out of date. You know, instead, with having electronic connectivity to the internet and the world, the question isn't study the solar system, how many planets, what are their names, what's the order. The question is, how many planets are in our solar system? And the kids can go out and try and find out, because it's still an open debate now. Is Pluto a planet or not a planet?
Right.
And what about those other rocks they just discovered that are circling the sun? Maybe those are planets. You know, and so it opens up that avenue rather than just reading this book that was written in 2003.
Yep.
That
yep.
says there are 9 planets in the solar system. Well, no, there aren't 9 planets in the solar system. Maybe not. You know, maybe there are, but we don't really know. You know, and it reminds me of when I was in college, even. I was taking a Soviet politics class, and this would have been 1989. And typical, you know, semester begins, and I probably spent $150 on books. 2 weeks into the course, the professor stands up in front of us, lists off about half the books we bought. She says, throw them out. She says, better yet, save them for a history class. But they're history now. She says, that's not Soviet politics anymore. Just yesterday, in the New York Times, if you read it, you know, they just established the Congress, you know, this new Congress, and, you know, all this stuff, because it was through the whole glasnost out, you know, after that,
yep.
And the entire Soviet structure just fell apart,
yep,
in front of us. And she said, you know what, your new textbook, it's the New York Times. You know, she said, forget all those stupid books, they're meaningless, they're history books.
Right,
right.
You know, and this is a way, you know, having this kind of connectivity, you can teach that way.
Yep.
You don't have
yep.
to worry about what's in the book. And, you know, some of the things that I know a lot of teachers do in history classes now is, you know, when we're looking at things, whether it's as kind of mundane as the Olympics,
yep.
but it's an
yep.
interesting cultural thing, or the war in Iraq or whatever, you know, teachers used to do things like sometimes they might hold up a copy of the New York Times. Look at this headline, guys. You know, what's going on in the world? Oh, my gosh, you know, there's a war in Iraq, right? Today what they can do is, kids can go and look at headlines from around the world and compare, well, how are the British portraying this versus us?
Yep.
You know, I see
yep.
it all the time on my RSS feed, because I've got CNN and BBC News. These are the first two ones. And it's always interesting to me to see the stories that CNN posts versus what BBC posts.
Mm-hmm.
But you can take that further and start looking at other newspapers from other places who have different worldviews, and what are they posting? You know, what is their spin on the vice president shooting a guy?
Yep.
Did it even
yep.
make the front page, you know, when it's been huge news here, say?
Al Jazeera.
You know, right, and so being able to look at that, because it gives kids a better understanding of the larger world they live in, that, you know what, history is written by the winners, right? And so depending on where you are, the history is different, you know, and I think that's a very important part of history, and these kinds of tools allow that to happen, rather than saying, well, kids, next Tuesday, we're going to meet in the computer lab, and we're going to discover what history is around the world. But then we're going to come back to our room and read the book.
Yep.
You know, I mean,
yep.
it just doesn't work anymore. You can't rely on that computer lab, because it's you know, and in most schools, that computer lab's used too often for these application-based courses, which we've continued to encourage schools to dump. Get rid of that application-based course. If you have some sort of sixth-grade required class, everyone has to take computer class. They learn to type 25 words a minute. They use Word, PowerPoint, and Excel. Waste of a class.
Yep.
Waste of
yep.
instructional time. Right. Get the computers in the classroom with the kids, one-to-one. They'll learn the word process on the fly. We don't have to worry about that. You know, and if they need a little help, there's plenty of resources to give them a little help. But to focus instructional time on JJ space, you know, it's pointless. You know, I think every teacher will tell you, I don't have enough instructional time with my kids. So this allows you, in a way, to offload some of those what people think of as basic skills, because you don't really have to waste instructional time on that.
Right.
So, you know, so there's a lot of different ways that they're being used. I think the struggle for us in kind of reporting to the legislature, and we started there, was that schools in general, as we noted before, don't have the time, money, or resources to do, even if they're not scientifically based, just to do kind of pretty good data collection. You know, I mean, they're obviously keeping track of grades and progress on kids, but to be able to do it in such a way that you can generate a report to show progress is difficult. And also because the progress you may be showing that the legislature wants to see is, you know, like, I want to see an increase in student achievement in grade 7. Well, year over year, it's a different group of kids. And we all know that every year, every group of kids is different. And what we're not measuring, and what is very difficult to measure in those kinds of styles, is not necessarily achievement, but increases in achievement. You know, at the beginning of the year, this is where my kids were. At the end of the year, this is where my kids are now. Versus at the end of the year, this is where the kids are. And when we compare that to last year's end of the year, this is where they were. Not a lot of change. You know, or maybe a lot of change, who knows. But, you know, it's a different comparison to say, you know, if I look at the last 10 years worth of seventh graders on this particular test, here are the scores.
Right.
Compared to if I look at where they started and where they ended and how much did they achieve through the year, how much growth was there. It's a different kind of measurement, but that's not what standardized tests do typically. So that's been one of the struggles, is trying to kind of figure out the best way to frame the conversation. Because I think intuitively most of them seem to recognize that technology has a role to play.
Right.
But part of the problem is that most of them, I shouldn't say most of them, but many people continue to view technology as a tool for finished products. You know, I want my kids to learn PowerPoint. They've got to make a PowerPoint. They need to know how to use Excel. You know, and they need to know how to use Word.
Right.
You know, rather than kids should be able to write, kids should be able to do quantitative analysis, kids need public speaking and presentation skills.
Yep.
And also, well above and beyond that, that technology doesn't have to be used to create those finished products, that technology can actually be used to learn those processes. You know, it's great that at the end of the game, kids can write coherently. The question is, how do they learn to do that?
Right.
And, you know, can we utilize the technology to help get them to that finish point?
Right.
You know, I think we can. We absolutely can. And people are doing it. Trying to measure that is real hard. But, you know, I think that we are. And I think that's one of the struggles, that a lot of our data is based on survey work with teachers, which I trust because I've worked with teachers and I know teachers. And I was a teacher and I trust my own opinion. When I was in a room, it'd take me 5 minutes. I could tell you if a kid was doing okay or not. Need a fancy test or anything else. And so when teachers report to us, things are better. You know, my kids do better with the laptops. I'm able to do things I couldn't do before. I can take kids further than I could before without. My kids, you know, are more engaged with than without. I trust those kinds of responses. I don't trust standardized tests.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it's funny. For years, everyone has always said, oh, yeah, SAT, whatever, and what do those scores really mean? And yet, anytime it comes to making decisions around things like these kinds of projects and allocating money, they all say, well, gee, did the SAT score change? You know? Or when we say, well, I want to replace all these laptops, they say, well, show me the evidence. And I turn around and I say, do you have a computer lab in your school? And they say, sure. I said, when was the last time you replaced it? Oh, just last year. They were like 4 years old. Why'd you replace them? Well, they were old.
Right.
So where's the evidence that computer lab increased student achievement in your school? Huh? Why would I do that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Show me the evidence that math book text series that you bought has increased math achievement. Well, the textbook doesn't do that. That's up to the teacher.
Right.
Same thing. You know?
It's a tool.
It's a tool. And so then you have to go back to asking the teacher, okay, so given your choice of resources, what would you rather have?
Right.
Computers or books? Right. Yeah. You know? So it's a different style. And I think it's the hard part is that oftentimes the people who are most vocal and most connected to these kinds of things are those people like probably our parents who, you know, are of an age group who are now, you know, 50s, 60s, and are highly educated, often have advanced degrees, and went through a school system that was the very traditional 20th century model, and it worked for them.
Yep.
And now we're proposing a hugely different model, and they say, well, what's the point? I went to Harvard, or I went to, you know, whatever university. I got this master's degree. I was highly successful in life. I was an engineer. made a, you know, a good living and put you through college. Why do you need to do something different?
The world is a different place.
Right. The world is a different place. And, you know, there was another study that I just got recently. I'll have to dig it up. Maybe I'll email it to you if you haven't seen it. It had all these survey work done of kids. I think it was from some of the Net Day things about their impressions of school. You know, it was very interesting to see teenagers' responses to things like, you know, whether or not they used computers and where did they do it. You know, and I remember some of the statistics we're talking about. Most of the kids say, yeah, I do use a computer to do my work, but I don't do it at school. I don't do it at school. I do it at home because at school I've got to contend with filters that get in my way. I've got to contend with, you know, all these other things that get in the way of me actually doing the work I'm trying to do. So I don't use the school's computers.
Yep.
Which is, of course, what we often see, though, is people saying, well, gee, every time I visit the school, the computer lab's empty. It's collecting dust. Why do we need more?
Right.
You know? Right. And so, you know, that kind of speaks to a different issue, which may just be the way in which we manage our technology in schools.
Right. It's a shared person versus personal resource.
Right. You know, and sometimes it comes down to, you know, what is the technology able to do? I think one of the things I always liked about, you know, the Apple systems I used to run when I netbooted them was, I had absolutely no security on them, you know, as far as application control and all that stuff, because they were netbooted, so kids could do anything they wanted. They could throw things out, move icons, didn't matter, because you rebooted and it went back.
Right.
Whereas what we often have in a lot of more kind of typical computer lab environments is these network-based logins with controls that don't let you move certain applications. You can't install, you can't do this, you can't do that, because, you know, the next guy's got to sit down and it's got to still work for him.
Right.
Changes the model.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Definitely.
Hey, so you had mentioned some stuff before about what you would recommend a school to look at that's going one-to-one or wants to go one-to-one. Can we wrap it up with some other ideas there?
Sure. I think that, you know, as schools look at, whether it's a school, a district, a, you know, a city, a state, whatever, if they're looking at one-to-one, I think that they need to back off of that conversation and go back to their roots, essentially, and start the question with what are our educational goals? What are we trying to achieve? Looking at that, then, you know, the natural course of events typically is if you can identify the problem, then you try and identify solutions.
Right.
And by and large, I think that many educational problems can be solved using technology in a one-to-one fashion. But I think it's important to get to that solution through that process so that it isn't starting with one-to-one and then saying, so what can we do? What problems could we solve with this? Because it's kind of a backwards model, because then you'll get a lot of, it's a whole lot harder to get community buy-in, which is very important. It's more important to start with, okay, what are we trying to do?
Right.
You know, and then how are we going to solve that? So I remember when I was at Brewster Academy and we did the same thing, this was like in 1992, you know, some of the problems were simply things like, gee, we don't have enough beds filled in this boarding school. We need to increase our enrollment. But also, one of the issues was simply, we've got kids who are so spread apart in the curriculum. You know, kids who are, you know, two grade levels behind in their skills, two kids who are Harvard bound in the same room. We have differentiation problems. How do I, you know, keep everyone engaged, all these different things? How do I try and assess and keep track of where these kids are in a multi-level classroom? The solution dawned, you know, came up with, well, maybe we can do something with technology. If we had more databases and systems that we could help track the data so we could very quickly see where the kids were and try and keep track of all these details. And that's what led them to one-to-one. You know, and so I think it's important to start with your goals, looking at what you're trying to do, see how what solutions present themselves, including one-to-one technology.
Yep.
The other thing I think to look at would be to make sure that as you go through those processes, that the technology is always kept as that, you know, it's a tool kind of thing. Don't let yourself get fixated on it, you know. And, you know, one of the things that I think often occurs, I mean, it's important to do, but it often gets, you know, kind of messed up, is that when you start to look at implementing these programs, one of the first things that comes up is fear.
Yep.
There's always a lot of fear, both from, especially from teachers, but often from parents and administrators as well, around the technology, usually related to things like inappropriate surfing on the web or having kids, you know, chatting with people they don't know and getting into trouble, you know, that kind of internet safety stuff. feeding, you know, and the ability, how much easier is it going to be to Google something? And then you also have that same basic argument that we all went through with calculators. You know, right? You can't use a calculator in a math class, then they don't learn the math, you know, because it's going to do the math for them. When, you know, we all know as math teachers, well, that's not really true. I mean, if I'm teaching computation, I'm not going to give the kid a calculator.
Right.
Right.
I'm teaching them something else, and computation is something we assume at this stage. It's fine, you know, because it helps facilitate the process so that we can focus on the mathematics and not the computation. So those issues arise, and some of the things that need to be done when you go through those things is you do have to deal with the fear. I mean, you can't just say, oh, you shouldn't be scared, because that never works.
Right.
Right.
But at the same time, you do need to have some really open and healthy conversations with those whole groups to let them know that from the administrative end, and much of this falls on the leadership, for the leadership to be able to tell those faculty, look, we recognize this is a scary thing to do. We recognize that there's going to be a lot of change and transition. Some things may not work as well. But we, as an administration, will assure you that we will bring to bear any and all resources we have to make it better.
Right.
You know, right.
So if I'm going to put laptops in your classroom, I'm going to make sure I provide you with that professional development. And I'm going to hold you accountable, but I'm going to do it in such a way that it's not like if you don't integrate every single piece of your curriculum into technology, you know, with technology, by the end of the year, you're fired. You know, that's not the point.
Right.
You know, because I think that's another one of the fears, that people start saying, oh, you think technology can replace me? You know, and they need to be told, no, absolutely not. This is a tool that, you know, we think is a powerful tool that we think you could take advantage of, and we want to teach you how to use it, but you are still A, number one, the most important thing in that room.
Yep.
Yep.
You know, and your parents think the kid is, and that's fine. But, you know, in general, it's not the technology, it's not the chalkboard, it's not the desk, it's not the book, it's the teacher that makes that classroom a classroom.
Yep.
So, you know, they need to have that assurance that the fact that the administration is behind them is going to bring to bear professional development resources. You may have to look at how you schedule your time, because sometimes things will take longer more effort to get done. You know, so it may be that, you know, you have to find another way to do bus duty or something, or, you know, some of those little things that seem kind of minuscule, but they add up and they take up time. And, you know, I guess the other thing would be when you get to the policy level, because that's the other place that fear runs in. People start talking about things like IMing, you know, and the kids are going to cheat, to try and get people to recognize, you know, we already have a school policy for that, because we probably do.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the school policies around most of those issues are simply that, one, don't do it. Two, the teacher, deal with it on your own. Three, if it really gets bad, call the dean. You know, I mean, it's usually about that simple.
Right.
The kids are jamming, that's basically passing notes. What do you usually do? Hey, cut it out.
Yep.
Kid keeps doing it, I'm method in class. I'm going to talk to you after class, or I'm going to give you a detention or whatever. You've got all those policies in place. A lot of schools went through a lot of pain recreating policies that were so convoluted and so complex that nobody enforced them, which then led to mass chaos. You know, people couldn't keep track of, well, wait a minute, that was a computer infraction 2B paragraph 4. Therefore, I have to take away your laptop.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's one of the last things you ever want to do, take away the laptop. Because now the next teacher in the next class period goes, where's your laptop?
Right.
Oh, Mr. Mao took it away. Oh, well, that ruins my lesson. You know, we were going to do something with that today. Now you don't have it. You know, so you can't do that. You know, you have to recognize, no, this is just like their math book. If they're playing with their math book or something, you say, stop playing with your math book. You don't take it away.
Right.
Right.
The only time you take it away is if the kid starts, like, ripping the pages out, you know, which in the computer terms would be dropping on the floor, banging on the keyboard or something like that, when the thing is in mortal danger. That's a whole other issue. You know, and you've probably got bigger fish to fry now if you've got a student who's doing those things in your face.
Right.
You know, if you're the math teacher and the student is looking at you straight in the eye and tearing out pages of the math book, you've got a far bigger issue than simply this kid is unruly in my class.
Yep.
And it needs to be dealt with on a human level. It's not a technology thing. It's not a textbook.
Right.
Right.
But I think they forget because they get blinded by the technology and having that distraction device. I think one of the last things would be that to remember that they're not alone in this, and, you know, remember that, for example, in the state of Maine, there's 3,000 teachers who've already done it.
Yep.
Yep.
And there are resources and places to talk to people about these things. You know, there's a lot of things I know a lot of our teachers have learned that are really simple, stupid things, you know, like simply telling people to close the lid on the laptop.
Yep.
You know, because sometimes you don't need it right now, or I need your attention, so close that distraction device.
Right.
And to recognize that just because you can doesn't mean you should. Mm-hmm. Right, to recognize that you know, often the best place to start when it comes to technology integration in a classroom is the topic that you hate the most, the one that is hardest to teach, the one that you've never been successful with. The one, you know, like for me as a math teacher, it was fractions, right? Teaching seventh graders fractions is enormously difficult, really hard, right? So I'm going to start there with trying to figure out how I can use technology to teach that, because if it fails, it's no different than last year, right? Nothing gained, nothing lost.
Yep.
Don't take the thing that you do supremely well and try and translate it into technology.
Right.
And then complain that, well, it used to be so much better without technology. Well, don't go there. Keep doing it if it's great.
Yep.
You know, if it's that thing that kids come back to you when they're not kids and they've got kids in the school saying, hey, this is Mr. Mao. He was my math teacher. Hey, Mr. Mao, do you still do that project where you blah, 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 blah? And I say, oh, yeah, of course I do. Well, you keep that one.
Right.
Right.
But you throw away that fraction lesson that never worked. You know, you think of something new.
That's great advice, Jeff.
That's great advice, Jeff.
You know, and the other thing I think is from the budget standpoint, you know, on the logistical side of things, to start to recognize that one of the recommendations we started to make to schools is to really seriously start examining their textbook materials. Is it really necessary to buy a science book, you know, in today's world? Mm-hmm. Doing? Maybe you can save that $60 a kid, you know, a book that you end up buying an extra 10 or 12% every year because some of them just get trashed. It's not going to totally pay for the laptop, but within that science classroom, it might pay for 4 or 5 USB microscopes.
Yep.
Or it might pay for some digital video cameras, or just might simply relieve the larger budget in general to help make them more affordable to you. I think in the private school world, but even in the public school where we're starting to move to it, we've got one school that's already doing it, having a parent buy program where the parents are paying for some or all of the device. But at the same time, recognizing that because this is an educational tool that our teachers are relying on, I would recommend that even in the private school world, and I know I've seen these go through in the nicest list all the time, this debate about, you know, well, if the parent owns it versus the school or whatever, who controls the resource?
Right.
Who has the administrative passwords? You know, while this device is used in school, the school should have the administrative rights to that machine, and they should be controlling the image.
Yep.
Because the teachers have to have that guarantee that when they can just say, okay, kids, pull up Data Studio. We need to do some work on, you know, some of these statistics, and know that it's going to be there.
Yep.
Not have the kids say, well, I bought a different model because I liked it better, but it could come with that title.
Right.
You know, if those simple little barriers get in the way, then teachers won't engage. You know, it'd be the same thing as if you told kids, well, yeah, you know, in our school, like in college, you buy your own books. But at least when you buy your own books, we said buy this book.
Yep.
But in the computer world, that doesn't always seem to hold because people are so personal about these things. They say, well, I know you wanted me to buy a Mac, but I like Dell,
right.
So I bought a Dell. Well, wait a minute. That totally screws things up now. You know, I was going to use iMovie. You don't have that. So looking at just kind of trying to simplify that model and, you know, and while kids will resist this notion that, well, I can't do whatever I want in this machine, I think that's where some of the concessions have to come in. Our image, for example, we lock down things like iTunes and iChat.
Right.
Next time through, I'll be lobbying to not do that.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, the iChat thing or IMing in general, we may end up still continuing to disable it initially, but try and make it as easy as possible for schools to choose to unlock it.
Right.
The problem that I have found is that I think IM, for example, is a great tool.
Yep.
Yep.
And can be used by kids appropriately if simply given the opportunity to do so. You know, and they have to be in a culture that trusts them. But by blocking it at the state level, what happens for us is the schools interpret that as the state doesn't want us to use it. They think it's not good.
Right.
When, in fact, the reason we blocked it was because we knew some schools weren't ready for it.
Yep.
They didn't know how to deal with it, and it was easier on 38,000 devices to block it first and let those couple schools that were ready for it to unblock it than to unblock it for everyone, have lots of schools who weren't ready for it run into a huge catastrophe and then scramble to try and block it.
Right.
It was the easier on the labor side of things. You know, iTunes was only blocked absolutely positively, 100%, because of the politics in 2001, 2002, when this thing began, Napster was all the rage, and everyone was stealing music. Yeah, and so politically, the climate didn't allow the governor, who himself has an iPod and uses an iBook, to leave it open because people were saying, "Oh, governor's giving out MP3 players to kids." You know, so we said, all right, we're going to turn that off for the kids then.
Right.
And we had to basically silence people and do that. But we have lots of schools who've turned iTunes back on again because of both of its integration with other tools and because if you let the kid have their music, which is very important to them, they take care of the machine.
Yep.
Yep.
Stupid little
crazy,
thing, but boy, it makes a difference. You know? But in the end, we found that schools that have been successful, they've been successful because the leadership in the school has taken on the project. They recognize that it's not a technology thing, it's a school issue.
Yep.
You know, the schools that have failed miserably are the schools where they say, well, I don't have time for that technology thing. Just let the tech guy take care of that. Because then, of course, if it's not on the principal's radar, it's not on the teacher's radar.
Right. Right.
Principals have to absolutely, and headmasters, tell their faculty, it is your job to use this equipment.
Yep. Yep.
It is your job to learn how to use it. I'll provide you the support. It is your job to find meaningful ways to integrate this. You know, I'll send you to workshops if I need to. We'll bring in speakers, you know, whatever. But you've got to do this. This is your job. You know, and just to silence the crowd when they start yipping and yapping is, you know, I know all faculties are good at doing it at one time or another over something.
Yep.
You know, it's just one more thing on my plate. Well, you know, it is another thing on your plate, but if used well, technology can take a lot of other things off your plate.
Right.
You know, it's just a matter of getting there. I mean, we know as geeks, we do things that most average people don't do with their computers. And I'll bet a lot of the stuff that we all do are mostly related to personal organization and management stuff.
Yep.
You know, I'm better at managing my email than most people, and you know, and things like that. But the amount of time it saves is enormous. And then when you talk to the average teacher, it says, oh, I get too much email, and I try joining this math listserv, but I can't keep up. I get 300 messages a day. I want to waste.
Right.
You know, and then I just stopped reading all my email because I just get too much spam. So I didn't see that announcement from the principal, you know. But learning to just manage those things, which is not rocket science, all of a sudden saves time because now you're not chasing down trying to find that announcement the principal sent you and, you know, and all those kinds of things.
Right.
Right.
So sometimes those little things can make a big difference.
Definitely.
Definitely.
Hey, Jeff, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I know it's
– Are you getting close to this or it's still in that kind of just talk phase?
We're having a
conversation
with
conversation
our teachers right teachers now about immersion for next year.
Okay.
And some of your recommendations have really hit me in great ways, and I, you know, I've been meaning to talk some more with our middle school head, and I'm going to have that conversation. Because the curriculum piece for me is really important, but as a director of technology, it's hard to have that conversation with faculty.
Right.
Because I'm not the person in charge of instruction and
instruction.
Yeah, and then that's what that's where, as I noted, that's been the failure in a lot of schools. It's been handed over to the tech guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As opposed to the curriculum coordinator or the vice principal who's basically in charge of curriculum or the principal or the, just, you know, the other thing that we've done in our project was we specifically at the start have continued to do so. We asked every single school to identify a teacher leader.
Yep.
Teacher leader is actually given a stipend. And the job description for that teacher leader is the, you know, essentially in most simplistic terms, a master teacher who is most respected in your faculty. You know, the teacher that everyone knows is the best teacher in the building. That's the lead teacher, not the one who knows how to use the technology.
Right.
I don't care what their technical skills are. It's the master teacher. We'll teach them the tech stuff later, but what you need is that teacher who everyone respects, and we all have one on our faculty where when that teacher said, like, you know, they can alter an entire faculty meeting. People can be arguing about something, and that person will raise their hand and say, you know, this is what I think, blah, 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 and everyone goes, yeah, you know, and completely alter any conversation because that person has everyone's confidence.
Yep,
yep.
That's the person you want looking at this, and, you know, if you can convince that person that you've won your faculty, and then you've won the war.
So I have two people to talk to next week.
Yeah, you know, you find those people and show them and convince them. You know, and hopefully they don't even need convincing. You know, if you have the simple conversation of, you know, what are your goals for your kids? What do you want them to be able to do? Where do you see them 10 years from now?
Right.
You know, what are they going to be doing? What's the world they're living in?
Yep.
Yep.
Technology will be a part of that. You know, and so some of it is just recognizing, oh, yeah, this is what we do in our world. Kids need to have this as part of their day. Do I have your email address somewhere? Oh, you just sent me an email. Yeah, I'll find that other document I had with all these student responses.
That's so
great.
Had
a lot of that stuff in it.
Cool. Hey, Jeff, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. I know that you have to get home to your family tonight.
Oh, yeah, look at that. It's Friday at 5. I'm probably the last one in the building here in the state. Especially the long weekend coming.
Yep, definitely. Well, thank you. And I'm going to put this together in a podcast, and I'll send it to you before I push it up.
Check out.
This is my beginning.
This is your beginning.
I've been doing some very short stuff, but Fred Bartels at Bartels. Country Day and I have been talking a lot about this.
Okay.
And I'm trying to tell some stories about one-to-one and get that conversation
Yep.
So.
Yeah, I have yet to dabble in podcasts except as a listener.
Yes.
Yes.
There's lots to listen for.
Right.
So.
But
that's where it starts.
Yep.
And their NCQ Talk is a great place to start. They have some really good instructional podcasts on how to create a conversation. And one of them is have more than one people talking.
Right.
And that's why this is a conversation.
Right.
Hey, thanks again.
Okay.
Say hello to your family for me.
You too.
And I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, good.
Thanks, Jeff.
Take care.
Take care.